You are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, episode 20, for Wednesday, April 27th, 2022. JJ Sefton, your host and personal envoy of good taste, along with CBD. And returning once again is our co-blogger and dear friend, the deplorable Jay Guevara. Gentlemen, how's everybody doing out there?
Hello, folks.
Hello, everybody.
So this week, lots of interesting things are happening that are making leftist heads explode everywhere and giving us here on the right reason for hope. And it sort of all falls under the rubric of, is the left in a general retreat, or is this just some sort of speed bump on their road to utopia, which is, of course, paved with good intentions and the blood and bones of innocent people? It certainly seems that a lot of good things are happening, not least of which, for better or for worse, whatever you think about him personally or his businesses, Elon Musk, the world's richest man, buying what was previously basically a house organ of leftist propaganda, Twitter. These are all very interesting developments that are happening.
Well, I'm not sure that the left is in wholesale retreat, but I think it's much more significant than a speed bump. The last year or so has exposed the chaos within the leftist mindset. It's, I think, caused primarily by the outsized control of their hard left factions. And I mean, we've spoken about this several times in the past, but the idea of transgenderism, of open borders. These are ideas that are anathema to an ordered society. And I think most Americans recoil at that. And the transgenderism is the one that probably tipped over most of America into, wait a second, are you folks fucking nuts? Again, is it retreat? No, but it's certainly chaos, which is a good thing.
Definitely. I view a lot of this as kind of an echo or a sequela from the Trump era. You see people like Ron DeSantis, he kind of really stepped up to the plate big time. And I think because the aspect of this that is relevant is that Trump showed that you can fight back against the left and actually gain popularity from it. Yeah, the media will try to flay you for it, but that doesn't really work that much anymore. So I see a lot of it as just kind of an echo of Trumpism.
Well, for sure, the border, yes, that is kind of alarming to most people, but for sure, as we talked about in previous podcasts, the last few, the issue of transgenderism or anything that comes near people's children or certain core beliefs of not just the so-called right-wing fundamentalist religious Christians, if you will, but certainly blacks and Hispanics and other people of faith who may fall under the category of traditional Democrat voters who say, no, these cultural things are definitely crossing a line with us. So fighting back and drawing a line in the sand and saying, no, this is definitely not going to stand is reason for hope, even as a lot of things are crumbling in on us. I mean, I've just seen some polling that is absolutely disastrous. I mean, if you can believe polling, especially, you know, I guess we're whatever it is about 5 months or 6 months out of when the elections are happening, everyone is predicting disaster for the Democrats in 2022, and Biden personally is at some ridiculous amount, like 30%, and that's with even with his core constituencies and even with youth voting. So that the only people that are still supporting him incredibly are the so-called wine moms and the Karens, the you know, women of a certain age, and I guess who either are childless or who don't care that their children are being used as either sex toys for perverts or being disfigured in the name of transgenderism. Yeah, interesting times ahead with all of this focusing in on just a rejection of the path that we're on.
The transgender thing, too, I think is a way of peeling off the wine moms, if they're truly moms. Attacking their kids, you know, is one thing, you know, is really quite different from kind of signaling virtue and things that don't really matter. Like, you know, the hate has no home here or whatever else. But they start going after their kids. Now they're going to honk about that. That's where I think they draw the line.
I agree. And it's much more of a, it's much more than an academic exercise when one is personally involved. I've been thinking over the last week or so, my personal relationships and the people I know who have had contact with transgenderism and, you know, the non-binary 57 genders, all that other crap. And I cannot think of a single person who is even remotely supportive or actually even neutral about the topics unless they have personal contact with someone who is involved in that sort of lunacy. And that tells me that there is very, very little power within that argument to draw people in. And that's what's so puzzling about the wine mom, you know, the suburban 40-something mother, 30, 40, maybe 50-something mother. I don't know why they are so exercised by the whole idea. It puzzles me, and I haven't heard of a cogent argument that explains it. But regardless, I think it's a losing argument for the left, and more power to them. I hope they stick to it.
It also seems to be coupling, and it's not really a social issue, but just the issues of the economics issues that were always bread and butter, meat and potatoes, if you will, of conservatives, so to speak. You know, we have hyperinflation or incredible stagflation that is happening. We have gasoline shooting through the roof, unemployment, and we're about to open the borders and flood the country with millions of illegal aliens who are going to take jobs away, theoretically. I don't know what jobs they're going to be taking away, considering we've shipped our manufacturing and most of our jobs overseas. But those issues also affect these core constituencies of the Democrats who probably before never really thought about it, or not to unfairly tar and feather people, but you know, it's the welfare crowd, you know, who basically have their hand out and are wards of the state, if you will, with every program under the sun. Maybe also be a holdover from the Trump era, in that blacks and Hispanics and other minority groups that were traditionally underclasses were elevated to such an extent, economically speaking, that they had record unemployment, record employment, and people were getting off of the welfare rolls like never before. So I guess maybe in a way, culturally, this too has an effect, along with the transgenderism and the sexual politics, of just turning into a backlash of really historic proportions against the Democrats. Question is, can the Republican Party channel this into some sort of an effective messaging that harnesses this anger at the party, at the Democrat Party, and draws them to vote for Republicans as opposed to just opposed to Democrats? That's the big question, I think.
But that's a fascinating question, and I think that over the last several months, we've seen the Republican Party, the traditional GOPE Republican Party, failing at controlling the narrative. I just read this morning that the Kansas legislature overrode a veto by their governor about transgenders participating in high school sports, against, you know, men competing against girls in high school and other sports in Kansas. That kind of stuff is happening more and more. That's that grassroots response to absolutely ridiculous overreaching by the left. Will it continue? Yeah, I think it is going to continue. Unless something derails this movement, we are going to see more and more successes, just, you know, regular people pushing back against the insanity.
Well, I think I'm baffled by why the left chose the transgender business as an issue. I mean, I understand it's kind of a metastasis from the homosexual initiatives that they promulgated, but why did they choose transgender? I mean, what is that, like a tenth of a percent of the population, legitimately? And it's sort of the sort of thing they could break their teeth on easily. This is not a popular thing here at all. Most people don't know anyone who is transgender anyway, and it strikes most people as a symptom of mental illness more than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes no sense. The only thing I can think of is that I believe that over the course of the battle of the so-called culture wars, which is, or the long term of it, going on now about well into decades now, especially with the fight for gay marriage, if you will, I just think they're sort of drunk on their own, in a way, on their own power or their own ability, they think, to influence the trajectory of the culture, and in that way the trajectory of society and government, and they think they can pretty much get away with anything. I mean, it was the other day, the transsexualism aside, there was some either university professor or somebody somewhere basically saying, you know, pedophilia, yeah, not so bad, it shouldn't be, it's not such a bad thing. And here we were years ago, people were warning with gay marriage, saying, look, this is the next thing you know, within 10 years, they're going to try to normalize pedophilia, and people were they were laughed at, and here we are 10 years later. Yes, that's the reaction. It's the shifting of the Overton window, as CGD has mentioned in the past, is that you put something out there that's so incredibly outrageous that it engenders a reaction. But the fact that it is out there and it is in the ether, if you will, means that it is a fair game, and it is a football that's on the playing field that's going to be moved. And obviously it only ever moves in one direction, and that's towards the left. So it might take 10 years, might take 5 years, but the fact that it's there, it's in the consciousness. Now, this whole
That speaks to Jay's point. Why did they choose transgenderism? I think for many Americans, that's a bridge too far. It's not turning the other cheek to homosexuality. It's not simply looking the other way when two men are holding hands walking down the street. Did that irritate people? Sure. But those are two adults behaving in an inappropriate way, perhaps, to many Americans. But in the grand scheme of things, what they really do in the privacy of their homes is not our business. But transgenderism is something radically different. And to answer Jay's question, I don't think there is an answer. I think the only one that I can think of is hubris. They thought they could do anything. And with the election of Biden, it exploded.
I think it's kind of a fallout of like the CNN Plus thing. So I've always wondered, does the left actually believe their stuff, or are they just conning the rest of us? And the CNN Plus fiasco convinced they actually believe their story. They think that that's actually the case, that they thought they'd have 29 million viewers on CNN Plus. They're obviously on drugs. There's something wrong. I mean, they believe, you know, they're eating their own cooking. They believed that. They weren't just trying to con everybody with that. They con themselves.
I've always wrestled with this question: is does the idiocy drive the ideology, or does the ideology drive the idiocy? Is it a combination of both? And I think they are so, you know they're so wrapped in their own bubble that they do believe this, I think. I mean, some people, maybe they don't believe it, but I think the longer you sort of marinate in all of these things, wherever you are, whether you're in a faculty lounge and then whether you're in the halls of Congress or at a cocktail party in D.C. or in Beverly Hills or wherever it is, you actually do believe this stuff. And it does, over time, it does rub off on people. Now, the problem is usually these things were always limited to the faculty lounge or the most fringe areas of debate in the most liberal parts of America. But the problem is all of these people have now migrated not only into government, but into mainstream America. Look at the boardrooms of Disney and Levi's and Coca-Cola and half 100 other major corporations and companies all up and down the size chart of corporations, if you will. And this is the problem we're dealing with, is that it's the attitude has infected all of society. So they are drunk on, they do have in essence a power to influence people, but they control, they're at the controls right now. The problem is we're all sort of under them and trying to sort of figure out how do we wrest power back from them.
But how much of that is a long con? How much of that is, you know, a group of people in human resources at Disney who are a vanishingly small portion of the total employment at Disney find a couple of fellow travelers on the board and they run with this insanity? How much of that is simply them figuring, well, you know something, this is a way to get raises and get some bumps in the power structure, and I don't really care. I'm going to go for it. The same thing with, it's not really the same thing. Why don't you cut that out?
Okay, it's not the same thing.
Sorry about
no
that.
Problem. Well, the thing is, here's the whole thing, is the fact that you have diversity, inclusion, and equity, the DIE thing, officers at these corporations, this is a thing now. These are major, major C-suite executives. And these titles and these departments never existed. It was always, whatever, human resources, or it was the personnel department. You hired the best and you fired the worst, and that was it. And the fact that you have these departments, it's not necessarily just really, I guess, an outlier of, of what, it's almost like in the old days, or what was the movie? I guess it was Goodfellas, where you have a company, or you have a bar, you have a store, and it's you get shake down, and the mafia guys come in, they shake you down, and they put somebody's cousin, in the company running the company. Well, what do? They run the company into the ground, and they burn it down, and they just collect the insurance money. And so this is sort of the moral equivalent of that. This is, they basically hold a gun to their heads of, look, you're going to hire, 20% blacks, 20% Hispanics, 20% transsexuals. You're not going to hire any white people, and if you don't do it, we take you to court, and we destroy your reputation on social media. So,
this is the shakedown of the Rainbow Coalition 20 years
bingo.
Later.
It's amazing how, God, what's going on right now makes what Sharpton and Jackson did like a penny ante operation. It really is. I mean, this is not just for one company. This is literally for all of America.
But why is it the tide seem to be turning now? The irony of this, and you can savor this irony, is social media. If it weren't for Twitter, we wouldn't know what a lot of these idiots think. And they put their idiocy flag out and proud. And now we realize, wow, we're surrounded by lunatics.
Absolutely.
we didn't know this before. They were on the down low. They had no voice. Now they've got a megaphone, or they did until Musk bought Twitter. Like this, they had a megaphone, and people realize, wow, we have a problem here. We didn't realize that before.
You know, part of that.
Well, that's a perfect segue into discussion of Twitter and what that means for America. But let's take a break.
We'll take a break. Be right back. Cut Chick Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, back in a flash.
Our break house.
And we're back, J.J. Zeftin, CBD, Jay Guevara, Cut Chick Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. And before we broke away, we were teasing you, talking about social change and everything with social media. And now Elon Musk purchases Twitter.
Well, I think it's very possibly a very, very good thing. And what Jay mentioned before was that the left had the opportunity, primarily on Twitter, of flying their lunacy flag, their crazy flags. And they could say whatever they wanted, and any rational response was promptly stomped on by the Twitter algorithms. Now that Elon Musk owns the company, or has a controlling interest in the company, I wonder how much of that stomping is going to occur. And I think that's what people are afraid of, that crazy ideas will be challenged now, hopefully. Again, we don't know how this is going to shake out. And for all we know, that Musk did this for some other reason. He's looking out for one person on Earth, and that is Elon Musk, which is fine. That doesn't bother me. He shoots cool rockets up in space, and I like that. So, anyway.
I'll go on a limb and say he has painted him a target on his back because of what he's doing. He may be trying to thread some sort of a needle here. The fact that you have made voices and made yourself known about free speech, and he commented this morning, he thought that the embargo of the New York Post expose about the Hunter laptop before the 2020 election was a horrible decision. And that's one thing. He's been at war with people like Pocahontas Warren over taxation and things like that. So, you know, when you're going up against very powerful forces, if he has some sort of ulterior motive, the fact that he's putting himself out there to be stomped on by the government, whether it's the FCC or the SEC or the IRS or whatever it is, why would you want to do that? I don't think he's disingenuous. I think he really believes in free speech and in free speech for all. So whether he sees the current junta as an existential threat is something else entirely, or whether he's just sort of, he's a libertarian or whatever, however you want to call it. But look what they're already doing. They're already putting SpaceX through hell down in Boca Chica by the EPA not giving him clearance to build his launch site. That's absolutely just punishing him via government. So I think, I think he's in this for the long haul, and for whether it's for the good reasons or whether for profit. Either way, it his being there and doing what he's doing profits all of us in the sense of opening up avenues of free speech that we were excluded to for a long time.
Well, he's taken the lid off the trash can of leftist thought, basically. And we look in there and we go, wow, it's really funky in here. But the thing is, at this point, I think he's doing it for good reason, because I can't see an upside to putting this target on your back. I mean, they will flay you like this. As you see, the government, and they would use social media, except now he owns part of it, the social media. But they'll sic the government on him. There's no question about that. There will be lawsuits, the way they did Sarah Palin, you know, the lawfare like that to make his life miserable. But on the other hand, he's got so much money that he's a formidable foe, and he can afford to pay lawyers like this to fight back. But I don't see any financial or economic upside for him doing this at all. I think it's out of conviction. Maybe I'm being naive. I don't know.
No, I think you're being rational. I'm just holding off until I see concrete results. But sure, your analysis is reasonable. So and I hope you're correct.
Well, what he's got to do, I mean, for me, the big tell, will he get rid of this, what's her name, Vijayjay,
legal
grabber,
yeah,
whatever. Yeah, she's what it's called the Truth and Integrity Department, which one of those Orwellian names.
Well, that
departments,
that's why
which
took
is
a shot about the New York Post article. That was a clear message to her that she made a mistake. And I think once he consolidates his power within the company, the first thing he will do is fire her. I hope if we see that, or if she leaves, then I think there's hope for Twitter. The question is it going to remain the biggest town square in America? Now that it has a chance of being a balanced place, I hope it does.
Yeah, me too. Well, I think he needs to get rid of Agrawal as well. I mean, I don't think it's coincidental that they're both Indians like that. That defies probability, I think. So basically, I see, you know, the fish rots from the head down. Agrawal be my first casualty. I'd walk in with pull out a list. The following people are fired, you know, and it'd be Agrawal and then Vijayjee and probably any number of others are out on the street.
I don't know that it's basically as a result that they're Indian, but for sure it is kind of interesting. Well, I mean, not to be whatever. I mean, India somehow became this. You know, all your call centers, all your tech support, everything is in India. So it's just a question of that's where this sort of expertise was, ironically enough, farmed out to or exported because, we didn't want to pay our graduates over here. We wanted cheap labor over there, which ironically enough, they get wealthy enough and Mumbai becomes a booming tech hub. And then they come over here and emigrate. So it's just sad that that many of them, unfortunately, gravitate to this totalitarian mentality.
They're technocrats without a sense of freedom and liberty. And I think that describes the top of Twitter quite well. Is it coincidence that they're overrepresented? Who knows? I think it's interesting. But
well, what I meant by that was Agrawal hires, you know, Vijayjee.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I mean, it wasn't disparaging.
It's actually Vijaya, not Vijayjee.
I was going to say, that's almost the same.
I guess Vijaya is better.
Yeah, whatever.
We're in trouble with the Indians.
Disparaging Indians as a whole nationality. I just meant Indian one hires Indian two.
I know you
this,
weren't
This does
doing
not
that
strike
yet.
Me as a coincidence.
No, but I think that the Indian mindset it applies here because it is quite technocratic. And there's a reason why there are call centers and back office operations throughout India. The big banks do a tremendous amount of work in India because they are quite good at taking direction, that they are technically expert. Perhaps Indian society in general has not taken the next step to an appreciation of liberty and freedom. I don't know. That's stretching it, but...
Hold over from the caste system, who knows, maybe. It's, you know, these things die, you know, of course, it's thousands of years old and they die. But then again, you know, who is Donald Trump's right-hand man? I forget his name again. And he was right in the mix with everything, and one of his core supporters, even with everybody else stabbing in the back, and I forget his name. And he's been, you know, excoriated over, you know, the election theft. I wish I... My mind is not. But anyway, he's the other side of the coin. He's a real superhero in my estimation. I wish I could remember his name.
The irony of the call centers and everything else is, why are there call centers in India? Why are they a tech hub and everything else? Because they speak English, okay, and that's because of the Brits, colonizing them. So. That's been a huge plus. Otherwise, would we have call centers in China? No. Like that? I mean, there's some English speaking, but they speak English in India. Of a fashion, at least. I mean, it's sometimes heavily accented, but even so, they understand English. The upper castes and stuff speak English, you know, quite well.
It's a fascinating country. I mean, it's the meeting of East and West. Gee, I think somebody wrote a poem about that. You have the tremendous British influence. British Empire influence, and yet you have the Asian aesthetic, which is in direct contrast to what Britain brought India, and I think it's fascinating. And you see it reflected in some of their politics, and certainly in their behavior vis-a-vis freedom and liberty versus authoritarian control from the top.
Well, I read a sorry.
Oh, sorry. The name I was thinking of, by the way, is Kash Patel. Yeah, he's a real. He was one of Trump's either national security advisors or one of his policy advisors that was right up there in the mix with like Stephen Miller and Peter Navarro and so on and so forth. And he was a real staunch supporter until he got targeted for termination. Anyway, go ahead.
It's interesting that the cultural melding cut two ways because I was reading a history of the Sepoy Mutiny, which was really ghastly, and. After the Brits reestablished control, they hanged a lot of the mutineers. But the leaders of the mutiny they tied over the muzzles of cannon and fired them. And where did that came from? The Mughals, like that. That was the traditional punishment of the Mughal Empire, and the Brits had adopted that, I guess, to, you know, speak the language of yeah. the people would understand. But you think it's remarkable. It kind of cut the other way as well.
Well, the brutality of Asia is unbelievable. You know, we talk appropriately so about the brutality of Nazi Germany and the Final Solution, and particularly in Eastern Europe and Western Russia. And it was a horrible, horrible thing. And yet people are less aware of the Japanese army's behavior in Korea and China. And, oh, my God, everywhere else in the Pacific. They were unbelievable in comparison to any normal human expectation of behavior. And I think that it's reflected in their, certainly in China's belief in the sanctity of human life, which is a vanishingly small idea in China. Life is cheap.
Look what they're doing, and we talked about this as well, in both Shanghai and now, I think, possibly in Beijing with these lockdowns supposedly over a coronavirus breakout, which to me makes no sense considering what we know about the lethality of all the variants of this thing. Yeah, they're just literally forced. People are jumping off of high-rise buildings because they're locked in and they have no food, no access to food. And it's, they don't care. And let alone, of course, Mao killing 60 million people and whatever, in the Great Leap Forward and or throughout his career. It's just, it's life is cheap. It's really, really... It's stunning. It's tragic.
So I was thinking when we were talking about Twitter and Elon Musk, as a segue into what the minority leader in Congress has done or has said, the one good thing about this explosion of social media has been that conversations that were normally private are no longer private. And I think that's a troubling thing, but it's also in many ways a good thing. People have to be very careful about what they say because somebody's going to find out, and that recording is going to go out on Twitter or Instagram or whatever it is. And I like that. I like that McCarthy is having to defend himself, that he was publicly critical of the attacks on Trump, mildly critical of the attacks on Trump, but privately he was cheering them on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was this whole stupid kabuki theater of whatever it was, censuring Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney. And, they're no, whatever. I'm with the people. They were what they've done in with the J6 commission and supporting Donald Trump's impeachment is beyond the pale. Meanwhile, here the year is behind everybody's back, and it's discovered that yeah, we're going to figure out a way to get rid of this Trump guy. what the hell? So it's like, yeah, this is a good thing. Absolutely, that it's sunlight is the best disinfectant. On the other side of the coin, you have Trump going on an interview with Piers Morgan, and then all of a sudden he comes out. Yeah, Donald Trump walked off the set in a huff. And it's like, what kind of crap is that? Then later on, he recorded the whole thing. And it turns out it was a complete crock of shit. He didn't walk off the set at all. It was like, and so just, it was an editing job as is befitting the legacy media of doing. So, two-edged sword.
Yeah, but Trump's response to it was quick and it was smart, which tells me that he is perhaps becoming more aware, which is a good thing. Absolutely. I still don't want him to run for president in 2024. No. I want him to be the elder statesman of the conservative movement in America. I think that he can be a kingmaker outside of the political process.
Well, the interesting thing, too, is that social media has, to some extent, served the function that we would have expected from the mainstream media, and that is investigating, reporting, and things like that. Whereas we know now that news in the mainstream media is massaged as Kobe beef. I mean, who knows what people actually said or did, whatever else. But with social media, especially Twitter, the word can get out instantly and not be filtered at all. So people are going to fly their idiot flag, fly away. And like it can't be massaged out. The internet is forever. You can't walk it back, take it back or anything, or claim you were misquoted. There it is in black and white. Or in pixels.
Circling back to circling back to what we talked about before the break, questioning how the hell did they settle on transgenderism? How did this thing, where did all of this come from? Well, a lot of it is because of, you know, a positive side of the lockdowns when children were forced to have Zoom class sessions remotely at home. You know, the parents were sitting in on it. And then all of a sudden the parents are sitting in on their children being taught that America stinks, that white people are inherently genetically predisposed to being racists. The country needs to be taken down several notches, if not totally destroyed. And you have to apologize to every person of color that you see, and in perpetuity. And plus the whole, you know, daddy has five vaginas and they're all attached to one person. And it's his boyfriend or whatever it is, and all this crazy psychosexual insanity. And parents saw this and went, whoa, what the hell is this? And that is what led to the Virginia Loudoun County School Board ruckus, where people finally, when they were able to attend a public meeting, they laid into them. And of course, what was the reaction from our Department of Justice and then all the way from the top at the White House is to label these parents as terrorists and as potential insurrectionists. So that it really was the one of the good things that came out of this whole Chinese coronavirus situation and the lockdowns, was that it exposed a lot of this stuff and it put a lot of heat now on the education or the indoctrination establishment. And that's where we are today. So having social media, hopefully with Twitter, maybe, and other things being equal, a more open means of communication and instant reaction to things, this is definitely a salutary effect, I think, on the body politic.
And yet they doubled down with transgenderism just, you know, over the last few months.
Disney, yeah.
Yeah, it's and they're losing, which is a wonderful thing. But look at what happened with Will Thomas at the University of Pennsylvania, the swimmer.
John Thomas.
Yeah.
That's right.
I refuse to call him Leah because his name is Will and he's a man. They, you know, the Academy, of course, supported him tremendously. They were apparently in private. The officials at the University of Pennsylvania were telling Will's, quote, fellow swimmers that they have to keep their mouths shut and not complain about what was truly going on in the locker room, which was actually quite vile. They doubled down on that, and they were excoriated everywhere. I doubt very much that next year at the NCAA Swimming Championships, there's going to be a man in the pool.
Well,
we'll see.
That's interesting. We can only hope.
Exactly. Well, I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, it raises the question to what, you know, that Jay brought up earlier, is that do they really believe this stuff, or is it intentional? I mean, does this Will Leah John Thomas penis tucker, does he really believe that he's a woman, or is he just doing this because he's a failed man and he realizes, oh, I can put fake boobs on, tuck my junk, jump in with the girls and beat him at their own game, and just... is he just doing it as a con job? I mean, either way, it's just totally, it's insane. It's absolute insanity.
It is insanity. And I think that people who have competed in athletic endeavors understand that what he has done is antithetical to the idea of competition. I know that Jay played baseball for most of his life, and the joy of playing against a better player is something that's very, very difficult to top. And the joy of holding one's own against a better player is something wonderful.
You shouldn't really say holding
one's
own.
Yes,
in this context, I think. But
and that's
I'm sorry.
So puzzling about
leave Jeffrey Toobin out of
Thomas
this.
Did. That is that he decided that he was incapable of competing at a particular level. So he chose to compete at a lower level because he enjoyed winning over the competition. Yet he was winning without real competition. Yeah. And I think it speaks very, very badly about his mindset, about the way he was raised, and about his psychological state.
His character, basically.
And his character. You know, a much better
word. I mean, that's the thing. If you're not going to enforce the difference between the sexes in competition like this, why have something like that in age? Why doesn't he go play Little League baseball or something like that? I mean, I could be, you know, world beater in Little League at this, even as a geezer. I mean, and I play in geezer leagues, and we have age brackets because, you know, if you're 29 plus, you can't compete with somebody who's 25. It's just out of the question. They're in the prime of life. The prime of life for us passed a couple months ago, easily.
Let me look at my watch. Yeah, right. That's exactly right. It speaks also to a broader, I think, philosophical issue. And maybe, I don't know if I'm stretching this or if I'm being, you know, whatever, you can smack me down. But the whole notion of all of these things, bit by bit, wherever they're coming from in this instance, it's just the attack on merit, the war on the meritocracy. And if all these things that degrade that, whether you get a participation trophy or whether somebody comes in who's completely, whether you have, you know, Reggie Jackson going into competing Pee Wee League and winning, all of these things are meant to just to degrade that, degrade the sense of a hierarchy of people who deserve something because they won it and they achieved it, and everybody else who didn't do it. And this whole notion of fairness and this whole notion of equity versus equality. And the whole idea is that, you know, when you lose or when you try to achieve something and you fail repeatedly, it's supposed to give you an incentive to get up, dust yourself off and start all over again and, you know, to sing the song. And the left has taken that and said, no, we're not going to have that. Everybody's going to be equal at one level. And of course, when we're all equal at one level, you have the masters, who are a few of those, and you have the controllers, and that's what it's all about. So we're in this race to not meritocracy, but mediocrity. And so when everybody is equal, everybody's going to be equally miserable. And then that's how you have the recipe of controlling society.
And the last bastions of those things were athletics and scientific discourse.
And the military.
They have very, very carefully eroded athleticism in America. And they are destroying the scientific method in America. And yes. Jake can speak to that.
Yep, no, it's absolutely true.
Pure energy.
And we're back, Cut Chip Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, CBD, J.J. Sefton here with the deplorable Jay Guevara in. And before the break, we were just talking about the death of meritocracy, and Jay Guevara has an expertise in the scientific field on this and has some interesting observations, sir.
Well, I was going to say, too, that we're talking about you fail at something, you try harder. Okay? But ultimately, failure is a signal like this. If you're failing consistently at something, maybe you should do something else and you might be successful. Like Will Thomas, you know, instead of beating up on the girls like this, maybe he'd be great as a marathon runner or something else like that. But we won't know because he's pursuing this thing. And as CBD pointed out too, the rot is now extending into STEM subjects, which I find truly deplorable, as it were, that should be the case. Because the sciences are based on objective reality. That's the whole idea. Empiricism is at the heart of the scientific method. You have an idea, you study something, the taxonomic phase. What's going on? You know, what happens? Then you have a conjecture as to what is happening, what controls it. Then you firm that up into a hypothesis. When you make it testable, then you carry out the test, the experiment. You compare the results of the experiment with the results predicted from your model, your hypothesis, and you assess the situation. Did your hypothesis predict what actually did happen, or didn't it? If it didn't, you need to modify or maybe just reject your hypothesis entirely. You know, you have that constant recourse back to empirical observation, as opposed to theoretically, you know, this should happen. And that's one reason, for example, I deplore string theory. It's ridiculous. You have, you know, introduced 17 unseen, unknowable variables. Yeah, you can explain anything at that point. You can't falsify the string theory and things like that. And that's one of the problems with leftist stuff, that they don't have recourse back to empirical observation. They think, for example, the problem with the vagrancy, they think, oh, they're unhoused, they're homeless. Oh, so we'll give them homes like that. That should fix the problem. It doesn't, because, you know, it's in their model, that should do it. The problem is they don't have a home. Now they have a home, problem solved. It doesn't solve the problem at all. And they realize, you know what? We're scratching where it doesn't itch. That's not the problem at all. But they never close that loop and say, empirical observation says, we're wrong. We're totally wrong. We have missed the boat. We have to try something else. That's one reason they're destroying STEM, is to avoid that problem,
which is a frightening, you know, a frightening prospect, is that you know, you're now going to have, I forgot what medical school somewhere, some engineering school, maybe it was MIT or somewhere, where they were saying, we're not going to hire, or we're not going to admit the most qualified candidates. We're going to admit based on skin color, based on sexual orientation, based on genital, what your genitals are, whether they're the original ones or they're strap-ons or whatever they might
aftermarket.
Be. Aftermarket. Aftermarket, exactly. Genitalia or whatever you want to call it. And this is not good when it comes to, you know, things like building nuclear power plants, if they, or even building their stupid windmills or whatever it is. Who the hell is going to design a windmill when you can't add one and one, or when with Common Core or with critical race mathematics, 1 + 1 = you know,
whatever you want it to be.
Whatever you want it to be, because the white man oppressed your grandmother or oppresses you. So all of these things are just this is the dismantling of society and turning us into some sort of, you know, into the killing fields. Basically, all we'll be good for is going into the field and, you know, picking rice, picking whatever, and we'll be just become an agrarian serfdom where anything goes. It's just
where we never walk underneath footbridges. You know,
Florida, at the University of Florida, right?
Never walk underneath a footbridge designed by a diverse engineering outfit. I mean, it's crazy. That's what I mean, but there's an objective reality here.
Well, that's the whole thing, is they reject, this is the thing, this all this thing is, they always talk about, it's the truth that you lived.
My truth.
Or it's your truth, or somebody else's truth, or there is no objectivity. It's all, everything is subjective. So when you have that, there can, and believe me, I don't believe necessarily in absolutes, but there are very, 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 very deep shades of dark, dark, dark gray, and very, 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 very deep shades of light, almost to white. Yes, there are nuances of things, but are we going to declare that the law of gravity is crazy, you know, or whatever it is? Hey, look, you think gravity doesn't exist? Here, go up, get up there and go out the window, start flapping your arms, and let's see you defy the law of gravity. So these things are just, they're taking us apart left, right, and center. Now, again, whether they believe these things or they don't believe them, or they're just using somebody else's belief or poisoning somebody's mind as a means of, as Lenin said, the useful idiots, just to gain power. That's six of one, half a dozen of the other, I guess.
But you look at, Lenin is a perfect example of that. 1917, they destroyed a barely functioning country, and they rebuilt it on tenets of Marx and Engels. And among those tenets were some chaotic and frankly nonsensical economic principles. And they fought and fought and fought until the early 1990s, when it simply fell apart. Because eventually reality intrudes upon everything. No matter how badly you want a socialist, God, I don't know how to describe it, but no matter how badly
dystopia.
You want socialism to succeed, eventually the laws of economics, which at one level are quite basic and quite obvious to anyone who is willing to observe the human condition and observe their interactions,
sure,
they will intrude upon whatever subjective reality you were trying to create, and objective reality always wins.
So it's otherwise known as bad luck. That's ultimately why it fails.
But even Lenin appreciated that, because he introduced a new economic policy after, you know, the economy had more or less collapsed. That in the early 20s, he said, okay, we're starving. I guess we have to go capitalism light for a while, like that, to kind of get back on our feet. So he, at some point, reality even intruded on his consciousness.
Yes, and Stalin didn't like that. Look what happened in Ukraine.
Yeah,
exactly. Not Ukraine now, but Ukraine, you know, almost 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Right, the kulaks, they collectivized the land. They didn't want to leave. They rounded them up, killed them all, and then they starved. And, of course, that was covered up by Walter Duranty of the New York Times media. It all circles back to that.
Imagine.
You know, it's funny you talk about Jay Lenin reintroducing a little bit of capitalism into the system. This is essentially what happened with China back, whatever it was, and after Mao's death, with the coming of Deng Xiaoping. They introduced a little bit of capitalism, and then in 30 years, they took off. Of course, we aided and abetted them by deindustrializing the West and putting all our factories, or many of our factories, in China, because we got cheap labor over there. But at the same token, the rising standard of living among Chinese who were born after Mao passed away, or died, or went to hell, I should say, you know, they got a taste of it, and they like that, and they like a little bit of consumerism, they like a little bit of social media. But now the Chinese all of a sudden are, clamping down on them as
well. They
as
like the trappings. Yeah, they like the trappings of a free market economy. They like the economic advantages of a free market economy, but they're unwilling to support a free market economy with liberty and freedom. And they go hand in hand, and eventually they're going to fail. I think on a small scale, you can have an authoritarian country that has free market principle. I can't think Singapore. Of any offhand. Yeah, Singapore. That's actually probably the best example. But a country the size of China, it's 1.5 billion people. I can't see them succeeding for the long haul without some flexing of freedom and liberty among the people.
Something's got to give there.
If there's ever a people, though, who are born for capitalism, it's got to be the Chinese. I mean, maybe not liberty and freedom, but the idea of capitalism and, you know, like you see in the restaurants and everything else like that, they're kind of born entrepreneurs and I don't know about entrepreneurs, that's too, but capitalists like that. They're as opposed to, for example, the Russians. You see, there's quite a difference between the two. If you get out of the way of the Chinese, their businesses will thrive.
The question is, I mean, look, I'm a big fan of American exceptionalism. I think that in the 16th century and the 17th century, the world conspired to send its best people to America. And it was that combination of a tremendous work ethic, a desire to be free, to have liberty from government, and some pretty bright people who came here over a couple of hundred years. That created American exceptionalism, which was and America was the most fertile place in the history of the world for exactly that kind of unfettered, not capitalism, but free markets. And we created an unbelievable thing. The question is, does China have what it takes to do that without that sense of liberty and freedom? And I think the answer is no. I think that it will stall at a certain point.
No, I agree.
My guess, though, I'm taking a little bit of a different tack, and is that because of all these internal problems that we've discussed on previous episodes with the cratering birth rate, you know, the one China, the disastrousness of the one child policy is going to bite them, and also just again this generation of people who were not really alive during the Mao era. Certainly they are now with the whole social credit thing and Big Brother constantly watching them. There is unrest, and there is definitely dissatisfaction among, I think, more Chinese and more people there than we are allowed to, obviously, to have a glimpse of. Hong Kong, well, Hong Kong is a special case because Hong Kong was a British colony, and they at one point they were free people, and then just the last, whatever it is, 25 years of being under the thumb of the communists, being more and more repressive as the years have gone by until we have Xi just completely squelching all freedom. There's definitely room for something that's going to give there. Plus, their economy is on a huge bubble there, especially the real estate market and other things. Yeah. They're in trouble. So is it going to be this burst of freedom, or is it going to be some sort of catastrophe that happens that either leads them to, you know, to invade Taiwan as a distraction or other things? It's kind of unknowable, but it's wide open. There's something. Something is definitely going to change there over the next, who knows, 5 years, maybe? I don't know.
You know, I wish you were correct, but I remember Tiananmen Square and having this. I was at a party, a garden party. I was living in Berkeley at the time. One of those beautiful days in Berkeley, and everybody was enjoying the wonderful weather. And I was talking to someone's grandmother, this 90-year-old woman who definitely had all her marbles. And she was extraordinarily upset by what had just happened in Tiananmen Square. And in my youthful arrogance, I said, oh, no. The Chinese people will rise up and they will push back against this insult to freedom. And certainly in a dozen years, China will be a different place. And I was catastrophically wrong. And unfortunately, I think that is probably what is happening now. I think that the communist dictatorship in China is sufficiently powerful and has sufficient control over all aspects of society that no matter what the Chinese people want, they're not going to get it.
And by the way, we can thank Google and Microsoft for that nice measure of control, because they've instituted the electronic, whatever you want to call it, that enables the whole social credit system. Hey, let's take a little bit of a break. We'll be back in 2 seconds. Hold that thought. Jay Guevara, Cutchip Newsletter Speaks. Back in a moment. return for our final segment. Jay Guevara wanted to continue on CBD's brainwave there, so have at it, sir.
CBD was talking about America benefiting from getting the best and brightest from Europe. And people who basically were in an inferior social position in Europe now had real motivation to come here, where that those social constraints would no longer obtain. And the same sort of thing happened in California for a long time. People who were constrained socially on the East Coast tended to come here. So we got the best and the brightest and the dumbest and the worst, both. But over time, what happens, though, is that social chromatography gets washed out. And that is to say, even if you had the very best and very brightest people in one place, over time, as the generations roll on, they'll return to the mean. And you can kind of see this in the case of Australia, that it was founded by, you know, populated by convicts who were almost entirely male. But now it's 50% male, 50% female. It lost that character that it had before, being essentially all male. So I think what has happened here in the U.S. is the same thing. At one point, we were a magnet for people who were disaffected where they were, who thought they could do a lot more if the constraints were removed. And now people have come here, generations have passed, and we have regenerated the slugs, basically. People who are perfectly happy just to sit around and endure things, as opposed to, you know, lifting themselves by their sagging shorts and getting after it.
That's interesting. Perfectly happy to endure things. And for many, many years, American parents were perfectly happy to endure things. But then the left overstepped and they brought transgenderism to kindergarten. And this is a strange segue. And they are no longer willing to simply endure. But I think Jay's point is very, very interesting. The question is, where should we reimpose social order to bring back the best and the brightest? Is it possible? Or has American exceptionalism been so diluted by three generations of social disorder and people allowing others to do whatever the hell they want to the detriment of society in general or society at large?
Is it possible to
reestablish social order?
I would say this. I would say that the reaction to the whole transgender insanity bodes well for that outcome, because if people sort of shrugged it off and say, well, it's just, we can't oppose it because we don't want to be looked at as hateful or whatever. The fact that they did, there was such a visceral reaction from all across the board, from, you know, despite the fact that, of course, the media is going to try to cover up that reaction or paint it in a bad light, that bodes well. That means that people do want the best for their children. I mean, look at the reaction to in schools where they're going after charter schools and they're going after the accelerated programs. The people who fight and who want those programs and who want those schools are residents of the inner city. They want their children to get the hell out of these horrible government-run schools because they see what happens. They will degenerate into lives of despair, disillusion, and an early grave. So there is a spark and an inkling somewhere, I think, of the American exceptional attitude to excel and to do better than your parents and to live a better life and to live a righteous life. So I think that there is reason for hope in that regard.
I think the mechanism, too, for what CBD was talking about, regenerating American exceptionalism, is meritocracy. That now, if you do well, if you're talented, you're hardworking, and have some luck, you can really do well like this, as opposed to everybody has to be leveled down to the same thing. Don't raise the bridge, lower the river, everything. Everybody's the same. Then there's no motivation for that, and then American exceptionalism is dead. Maybe that's the whole left's whole idea. I don't know.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. It is. It's exactly their idea. They want to destroy meritocracy. They want to destroy American exceptionalism because in their view, in their warped worldview, American exceptionalism is based on race. And basing anything on race is evil to them, except, of course, their own plans, which are entirely based on race.
Well,
I think that's just a topic they chose. Sorry,
well, it also boils down to the fact that if somebody does better than somebody else, then it's unfair. It's all fairness. Then we have to make it fair. As Ronald Reagan once quipped, he says, you put a skinny man next to a fat man, and the leftist is going to say, well, somehow the fat man stole the skinny man's food. So it's that, you know, that might be at the the nub of it. But of course, there's so many reasons. But anyway, gentlemen, I think we've reached the end of our hour together. It's been a great chat. This is the Cut Chip Newsletter Speaks podcast for Wednesday, April 27th. JJ Sefton here saying thanks to our guests and co-hosts and co-bloggers, CBD, and Jay Guevara. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Thank you.
See you next time.